What's up? Welcome to the OKB's podcast, episode 65. I'm one of your hosts, Blessing Adeoye. Joining me this week, as always, is the Jewish-Japanese wonder, Ian Prichelle. What's up, Ian?
What's up, man? Just being Jewish and Japanese, you know.
Yeah, man. It's wonderful. Am I allowed to say that? Am I allowed to call you the Jewish-Japanese wonder? Is that like... Will I get in trouble?
I'm fine with it. There are some rules with the how you say Jewish. So you... Okay, so from my experience, I don't like it when people say, oh, you're a Jew. So the short form is not cool to me. Much like the N-word. No, actually, no, it's different than the N-word. Because, you know, yeah, the A-1 is shorter, right? Yeah, so anyway, what I'm saying is there's two different forms, and usually, and there's two different forms of the word, and I don't like the way that the term, like, oh, you're a Jew. Oh, he's a Jew. What a Jew thing, essentially. That doesn't feel good to me, and it feels more derogatory. So I'd much rather people say, like, oh, that's a Jewish thing, or he the Jewish Japanese kid. Like, if you were, like, the Jew, the Japanese, I'd be like, ooh.
Is this a personal thing, or do most Jewish people find this short-term Jew?
I think it might be a personal thing, but I feel like if you asked a bunch of Jewish people, like, what do you like better being called, like, Jewish or a Jew?
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, to me it sounds like, oh, you're a Jew, is like, it for some reason in my head, it automatically, like, associates with, like, more derogatory. And obviously, like, when people have been anti-Semitic towards me in my life, they've been like, oh, you're a fucking Jew.
Yeah.
They haven't been, oh, you're a fucking Jewish person with ideals that I don't agree with.
Yeah. You know what I mean? No, I feel you. Yeah. I feel you. It's like, it's almost like saying black people versus the blacks.
Exactly what it is.
It's like when you say I can't stand black people, like, that's okay. But you say I can't stand the blacks, then it's like, hold on one second,
stand Jewish people and their crazy mystical religion. No, I'm okay with that. The Jews, the damn Jews and their wizard magic. That's okay. That's no.
Yeah, man. This is if you're listening to this podcast for the first time, Ian's Jewish and I'm black. And
welcome.
And I hope that contextualizes things a little bit. And I don't know if that makes anything.
We're just not two white dudes. We have something different about us.
The Jeff and John podcast. No, this ain't that.
And John podcast. That's going to be our new parody podcast where we both play really, really white Republican guys.
That's what we already do.
The Jeff and John podcast. I like that.
We're already there. Remember that the OKB's podcast is on its last episode because of everything we just said. The OKB's podcast is a weekly gaming and nerd culture centric show. This is where we get together and talk about the biggest topics in games and culture. If you like the show, subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice. Visit OKB's.com and follow at OKB's Now on Twitter and Instagram. We have weekly videos every Friday. This last Friday, I just uploaded my video all about Donald Glover, and that video tortured me. I love the video. I hated making the video because, like, 98% of the process, I thought it was a bad video. And then I got to the end, and I was like, okay, finally, I've landed on something good. And then, like, I'd export it. I exported it, like, four different times in the export. In the export video, there would be something wrong with each, like, there would be, like, a tiny detail wrong with it. And so, like, one of the times I'd export, and one of the effects would just cut to a black screen instead of doing the effect. And so, like, I had to export, and each export took, like, an hour. And this is like the day I needed to get the video up, and then I got the video up and I went to bed, and then I woke up randomly at 11:30. Then this is last night. I woke up randomly at 11:30 PM and I look at my phone, and there's a notification on my phone saying your video has been blocked in every country. And I'm like, oh,
in
great.
Every country.
in every country. It was very specific. I was like, oh, cool. It's not blocked here. It's not just blocked period. It's blocked every country. And so I guess somewhere outside of the earth, my video was available.
In space.
But I had to go back in space on the moon. The aliens were able to watch my video about Donald Glover because that's how popular Donald Glover is. So I had to take down my video, edit out the part. Thank God YouTube does the thing where it's like, hey, it's from this part to this part where the copyright
is claimed. I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that makes it a lot easier. And weirdly enough, I have a lot of stuff in that video that I was expecting to get claimed. I didn't think it'd get taken down. I think, like, it just, like, demonetized or whatever. Not monetized anyway, so it wouldn't matter. But, like, essentially, they took it down for a part I did not think would get taken down, which was the music during, like, the title sequence of the video. This part where Gambino is singing. He's doing a cover of another song, which
and the problem was that it was the cover. Okay.
Yeah, it was either that or what I think it is, because it did it through Content ID, because I got that video from a specific channel, and I don't know if it was the cover or the channel, like the other channel Content IDing my channel, because the channel I got it from, I'm assuming, is like a bigger channel, since they're able to get Gambit on to sing on and stuff. But it was a thing. I took it down, I redid the music for that part, put it back up, and I was able to keep it. But it was just like a random, like, middle of the night thing where I woke up and I was like, oh, sweet, I get to do this again. But my video is finally available, and I'm happy. Check that video out, because I put a lot of work into it.
The torture of video editing featuring Blessing.
God, I'm so glad that video is done with. How are you, Ian?
I'm good, man. I'm actually doing real good this week.
Nice. Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, because I didn't want to like be like just here complaining about my life.
Talking all about your life. Well, speaking of life, I started school. I'm officially a Japanese school person.
Oh, yeah, you're a Japanese school boy.
I am, officially. You get to, like, that joke, live out your life. That meme became real. You started saying that like a year ago, and now it's real.
So, like, is it exactly the way it is in Persona 5?
No, it's different. It's a language school, so it's not like a high school or anything. It's not like a college. I'm going to school with people. I mean, the staff of the school are all Japanese, and they're all Japanese teachers. But the people around me are from, like, all different countries, but mainly China and Taiwan.
Mm. Do you wear a uniform?
No, I don't.
That's disappointing.
I should. That's the thing I should wear a uniform every day.
Yeah, institute your own uniform, and just wear it. Like, just like have like a tie, a nice like vest,
but like halfway down.
Yeah.
Red tie.
Yeah. Yeah. Have it so that your shirt should be tucked, but don't tuck it in, because you're like the more like you're the ruffian. You're like
exactly.
The what's his name in the game in Persona 5, blonde haired kid,
Yosuke Ryuji.
Yeah, you're the Ryuji.
The roughnecks.
Yeah, you can be the Ryuji Kanjin of the situation. Ryuji.
Yeah,
yeah.
But yeah, I'm really enjoying that so far. School is awesome. It's hard. It's like five to 6 hours a day of just Japanese, and it's crazy because like I took a short course in college, like I think it was like 3 months or whatever, of basic Japanese. So like I already know how to read and write in some parts of Japanese, but like people are coming into this class without knowing anything, and they don't speak any English. They teach every single part of the class in Japanese. So if you don't know anything, yo, good luck. Like I was like helping, there's a girl from Sweden in my class, and she's like, I don't know what's going on. I'm like, I don't know how you would. They're not speaking any English at all. I guess it's like a part of like their methodology is that like they should only use one language to assure that you're constantly thinking in that language.
That's rough. I had a French class that was like that, because I took up to like I don't even know what the number was, like French 401 or something like that, French 204, something weird. It was like advanced French, intermediate advanced French. And I remember like most of the class would be in French. Like there are parts where you're just not allowed to speak English. And like, I'm not a language person. Like, I'm not good at learning languages. I took like 10 years of French just to get to like level 4. And that's not a joke. I literally took 10 years of French classes. Yeah, that was a rough class for me, because it was just like sitting down, just having people talk to me and just me not understanding what anybody's saying. And I'm like, are you cussing me out right now? Are you hitting on me? Like, what's going on right here?
I didn't like it growing up. Experience. But I feel like because when I was a kid, I learned Spanish in school. I learned Hebrew at Hebrew school. And then my dad and mom speak like a little bit of Yiddish and a little bit of Polish. So, like, I've been, like, there's been languages on the outskirts of my life my entire life, but, like, now that I'm just focusing on one thing, one language, and that's it, like, I feel like it's way more fun than, like, trying to understand another language while you're also thinking about math or thinking about three other languages or thinking about sports or whatever. I feel like learning a new language in high school or middle school is much harder, I think.
Yeah. Interesting. There's, like, a weird, there's a study out there that, like, shows
bilingual people have like more, like they're using more parts of their brain than others.
Well, not that, but it might be in relation to that, but more so about age and learning language, because apparently there's a certain age to where it's easier to learn languages. Like apparently, like when you're younger, like young, your brain is kind of programmed at that point to like develop absorb languages.
Yeah. It's like brain elasticity. Like your brain is able to like bounce back and forth between multiple things more quickly.
Yes. Yeah.
That's why people who live in a house with a mom who speaks like Chinese and the dad who speaks English, like they're able to bounce back and forth quickly because their brains are so elastic.
Yeah, that's weird. My parents both, and my grandma, because my grandma lived with us growing up. Well, my parents spoke two languages. My grandma didn't even speak English. And I shared a room with my grandma for like 10 years or something, and we never spoke the same language. but I never learned the other language, which is the craziest part about it. It's a language called Yoruba. It's
Yoruba, yeah, I've heard
one of the Nigerian, yeah, and one of the Nigerian languages. So that was always a fun situation.
I don't know if I've heard of that from you or from my friend growing up who is Nigerian, but
I don't know if I've ever mentioned it. But yeah, you probably, I mean, you've had to have heard it from like a Nigerian. So let's move on though. What have you been playing?
So, Blessing, I need help. I'm addicted to Stardew Valley.
I hate you. Literally last week. You're like, what did you say last week? Wait, did you say this last? Did you say this on the podcast?
It was either last week or it was like 2 weeks ago. I might have even just been in our group chat or whatever. But I said that the opening to that game isn't strong and it takes a little bit longer than most. It takes a little bit longer than I would have liked to like get the ball rolling. But like the same can be said about Animal Crossing, obviously, and like these other like Harvest Moon or whatever. It takes a while for like the actual game to get started. And the last time I spoke about it, I was in that weird interim phase where I was like, I don't know what to do, and like things haven't even opened up for me yet.
Bless you. Ooh, bless you.
Oh, I'm down.
Oh God, bless you. Somebody
but yeah, like so things, all the features hadn't been opened up to me yet, and I didn't really get the loop of like what I was supposed to do. But now that I'm like actually, I'm finishing up the summer month right now, and I feel like I'm finally kind of understanding what the game is asking of you. And what the good, like, the gameplay loop is. Yeah.
Nice. How do you know how many hours you put into it?
Oh, I have no idea. I would have to, like, check on my Switch. I don't even Switch doesn't really even have a good hour count yet.
It has, like, you have to play for a certain amount of days, but after, like, 10 days or so, if you go to your profile, it'll start saying, it doesn't have an accurate count.
It's, like,
count,
over
but it'll
blank
say,
amount of hours, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But I've played a lot. Like I've been playing like every day. Because again, like it's a good loop. Like, do you have the game or no?
No.
Well, it's fun. I like it a lot. And like pretty much you bounce back and forth between working on your farm and trying to have your farm as automated as possible. Like you have like automatic sprinklers. You can have like these different objects in the game that can help you, like make your like the growing of your actual crop automatic. And then you can build other things to take that crop and make it into something else. Like, you can take blueberries and make it into jam, or you can take eggs and make it into mayonnaise and stuff like that. And then that, like, artisan stuff you can sell for a higher amount of money. And then on top of that, when you're not doing the farming stuff, you're either going into the mine, which gets you raw resources, which then you can reinvest into your... Yeah, reinvest into your farm. I like it. It's got a good loop, I think.
Nice. Is it something that you want to take around and play? Like, is it something you're playing at home?
No, it's both, honestly, because I feel like there's so many different things to like craft and so many like objectives you can do at once. Like, the game gives you like a raw objective, like a journal, like, oh, do this thing and you get money. But then there's also this grander objective of like, okay, you want to restore the community center by growing these certain things during these months, and then that will unlock more things and make the community center more more alive, I guess. And so the game is always giving you these different objectives, and then you're also obviously crafting your own objectives because it's your farm, right? So maybe you want to invest more into your animal handling, or maybe you want to invest more into your like crop management, or maybe you want to invest more into your mining stuff. Like you just have your own choice and like where you want to build stuff, obviously, and like where you want to grow stuff. So yeah, it's really cool. It reminds me of Animal Crossing in a lot of ways, and yeah, I really like it so far.
Nice. What else have you been playing?
I've been playing Overwatch and Destiny, but there's nothing really to report on those. Overwatch, I got so it's the Halloween event right now, and the skins, I feel like I don't really like them as much as I've liked other event skins, to be honest.
Really? I saw screenshots, and the only one I've really seen is Zenyatta. And
Zenyatta. Zenyatta's is amazing. Zenyatta's is by far the best one. Nice. So Zenyatta's has Cthulhu, which is awesome. Mei has like a Jung Jang, which is like a traditional. I'm pretty sure that's how I'm saying it. If I'm not, I'm sorry. It's a traditional Chinese vampire. And then there is Reaper has a vampire skin. Then what's it's a Dracula skin. And then what's his name? McCree has a like vampire hunter skin. And then like there's a bunch of other ones like sprinkled around. Like Anna has one where she's a pirate. I can't think of other ones, but yeah, those are the big ones.
All about Symmetra's, I think, also.
Oh yeah, Symmetra's like, is really cool. Hot. Yeah, Symmetra's new skin is like super cool looking. She's got like a dragon motif to her. She looks very cool. But I don't really play Symmetra, and I don't really find her gameplay that interesting for my playstyle. So it's I'm not really invested. But yeah, like I like the Cthulhu thing, but overall I don't like the skins as much as I have in past events. But the reason why I was playing Overwatch was just to like get like my first like loot box or whatever, and I got I think like you they give you one by default, and then you get four loot boxes for playing each of the events once. So you can in theory get four loot boxes within an hour. So I did that, and I got the Mei skin on the fourth box. So
that's cool.
So yeah, I'm happy about that. And then Destiny, I've just been, you know, just doing my grind, beat the raid, and yeah, I'm 296 right now, and yeah, I'm enjoying the Iron Banner, and it's been fun.
Dude, I'm the only person that hasn't beaten the raid, even though I've gotten to Kalos, like, I think three or four times at this point, but I just haven't beaten him, sadly.
I have a question for you, actually. So, what is your opinion? I'm going to tell you a story first, and I'm going to ask your opinion. So, the story with this is that I've been wanting to do the raid, and I've been, like, I was trying to find people for a while. And then randomly I found Zyger, and then Zyger was like, hey, I'll do the raid with you and I'll get a group of people for you. And I said, okay, perfect. So we do the raid in less than, I think it was an hour and a half, the whole thing.
Dang.
Yeah.
And this is your first time?
Yeah.
Dang. Nice. Well,
but Zyger had done it a bunch of times, and so had the people around him, I think. So like we had an experienced group of people, and like they were a pretty high level. So I told that to somebody and they were like, oh, well, you're not even getting the full raid experience. And I'm like, what are you talking about, the full raid experience? And they're like, oh, well, me and my group, we went in blind, and it took us, like, 20 hours between 2 days or 3 days or whatever. And I was like, yo, okay, cool. Yeah. I'm happy for you. And, like, you hear people on, like, the Giant Bomb cast and stuff like that, and, like, all them, like, oh, yeah, it took us, like, 24 hours over the course of 3 or 4 days. And, like, to me, like, I completely respect that as, like, a way of thinking, right? It's like, oh, yeah, we're going to beat the raid with, like, our own puzzle solving, we're going to be smart, we're going to figure shit out. But to me, I don't play Destiny. Or sorry, let me ask you first. What do you think about that? What do you think is the right way? Is there a right way to play the Destiny raid? Is there a wrong way?
So I look at it almost like watching movies, to where like you see like there's Star Wars coming up, and the Star Wars trailer just dropped. And there are people that are actively avoiding that trailer because they want to go into that movie like completely free of spoilers or free of anything. I almost see like doing the raid void of like any knowledge of how to solve and all that stuff, the same way as going into a movie like without like watching the trailers or anything, going in fresh because you want that like pure experience. I think like I think as far as the way the people who develop Destiny design the raid, the purest experience is to go into it blind. But I also don't think that is the sole intended experience. Like, because the way I played it with my group is, like, two of the people in my group kind of knew how to, like, knew the solutions. But, none of us had really, like, beaten the raid before. Like, the two people that knew had mainly just, like, either watched YouTube videos or gotten to, like, or done, like, two parts of the raid and didn't really complete the raid fully through yet. And so like we went into each of the parts knowing like, okay, this is the goal, like we know an overarching idea of the things we need to do, but we just need to figure out like the flow of doing it and actually like execute on it. And I think the way we experienced it was pretty like cool. Like I still had I feel like I had full enjoyment from doing that. In fact, I probably would have enjoyed it less if I went into it blind, because like I hate hitting my head against the wall, especially with other people. Like if it's a thing I'm doing by myself, like I love The Witness, and The Witness is that kind of thing of like solving a puzzle by yourself. And like it's an extremely hard puzzle. Doing that with other people sounds super frustrating and is an experience that I do not want. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't want to go in blind. But yeah. I feel like going in with other people and knowing is fine. And even if it's going in with like a group of experts, if that's the way you want to experience it, I think that's fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
So here's my rationale behind it. And I completely agree with you that there are like it, everyone should have their own way of thinking, right? Like whichever is the best for them. But to me, right, when I hear people saying, yo, it took us 24 hours to do it over the course of 3 days, the only way my body reacts is this. No.
Yeah.
No. Like I could beat another game in the time you spent doing one raid. Like the whole point of the raid is to get gear and to see cool shit, for me at least. So I got to see the whole raid. It looked awesome, and I was able to focus on like the art and the architecture and like the systems of the game, as opposed to being worried that like, oh shit, I got to have my like brain up to 11 right now so I can focus on what mechanics are what and how do I beat this thing. As opposed to someone who like does something for like 20 hours, right? Like that's exhausting. It sounds like a marathon. Like I'm not trying to do that. Like,
yeah,
I play games for the fun of them and for the challenge of them, obviously. And like for the grind of being able to get to that high level. Right. So if I am told by someone I can get to the grind, I can get that gear faster, I can get to that next level quicker. Mm-hmm. I would always take the 2 hours of the 24. I can run the raid 12 times in the time it took for people to run it once.
Yeah, but isn't and that's that the way like, I see that's, it. To me, that's almost like playing. I keep going back to the example of The Witness, but it's almost like playing The Witness with a strategy guide by you, to which like you can do that and you can beat Witness and like.
But The
like,
Witness is designed specifically as a puzzle game, as a single player experience. Yeah. Not
that's,
only,
but that's also in, the raid. Yeah. The raid is designed
but
the, as a
but
puzzle.
But the raid is designed not only for execution. I think it's multi-layered, I think. And for me, the thing is, like, even when we had that group of experienced people, we still fucked up. There was a whole execution, like, barrier to getting the raid 100%. And to me, the only stuff that I care about in Destiny is the visual aspect of it, like the design of the characters and the creatures and stuff like that. And then also the grind of it, like getting to that next light level. So, like, again, like, when you tell me just straight up, hey, you can get 12 times the loot, if you do it with experienced people,
mm-hmm.
Sign me the fuck up. Like, I don't care about, like, to me personally, I don't think that the puzzles in Destiny or, like, anything in Destiny is designed to the same level as The Witness. Mm-hmm. Like, The Witness is crafted by this puzzle genius and is made for a certain type of person. It wasn't even made for me, and you can quote me on that. Like, I tried playing The Witness, and it was a little bit too slow and plotting for me. And that's just not the person I am and the gamer that I am. And Destiny isn't crafted by a puzzle-solving, puzzle-making genius. There's only so many things you can do with shooter puzzles in a group. And I don't find any of them to be interesting. Or sorry, I don't find any of them to be this like crazy epiphany sparking level thing like they were in The Witness.
Yeah.
And that's why like I'm not making any delusions about what I play Destiny for. I play Destiny for the shooting. And I play Destiny to be on the same level as my friends and play with my friends. So when I'm given the opportunity to play with my friends at the same level and get that grind at an accelerated pace, always sign me up. I don't care about like discovering the raid myself. And that's what I wanted to ask you is like what is your opinion?
I think that's fine if that's the way you want to play it. I think that's totally valid. Like for me, I think the thing I got out of the raid, because when I played it the first time, I think we played for maybe like at least like 12 hours. We played it throughout like, we started at like what, like 3 or something like that, and we ended at like the morning, or like not the morning, but like 12 a.m. So I guess technically the morning. And like for me, that experience was valuable. And to me, actually, I look at that experience as like one of my favorite experiences I've had gaming in a long time, because it wasn't. To me, it wasn't about solving the puzzles. To me, it was about playing with other people and just, like, and kind of, like, trying to not brute force the things with other people, but get to the next part with other people and kind of experience that struggle together. Even though like I've said before, that like I hate struggling with other people, but it was almost like just hanging out and like and you know there were obstacles, but mainly it's just like hanging out, coordinating, and having that like kind of like that hardcore experience. And like when I described it earlier, I described it as Spy Kids 3, the Destiny raid being Spy Kids 3, because it is like this like thing of working together to like to dominate these like impossible situations, because like you said, the puzzles in the raid are nowhere near the level of the puzzles in The Witness, but I think when you add the factor of six people, coordination, it then like adds that layer of like, oh dang, this is actually a lot harder now because I had to rely on five other people to also deliver.
I think back to my experience with the raid in the first Destiny, and I feel a parallel to what you're explaining. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with that as a valid experience.
Can I talk about Shadow of War?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
Yes. Okay. So,
oh, wait, you're playing it. What if I said no? Would you be like, all right, moving on?
It's like, all right, I guess we're going to the topics. No, like, our topic kind of involves Shadow of War anyway. But so as far as what I've been doing this week, I'm playing a lot of Shadow of War.
Is it good?
It's great. So I have mixed feelings on Shadow of War currently. If you ask me next week, I might love it or hate it. I'm not sure yet. But I love Shadow of Mordor. That's the first game I ever platinumed, actually. Like, it,
really?
100% it is that game, yeah. Shadow of Mordor, I was super into, and this is coming from someone who does not like Assassin's Creed, like, playing those games. Shadow of Mordor, I felt like, added the dimension of the Nemesis system, which I think actually fulfilled the dream of Assassin's Creed, because Assassin's Creed is a game about, like, assassinating your targets, and
Why don't they have that in Assassin's Creed? Creed?
I don't know. This is the thing I've been asking. Like, if Assassin's Creed added the Nemesis system into Origins, I would buy it hands down.
I'm going to buy it just because of the Egypt inclusion. Like, dude, every time people bring up the Nemesis system, all I want is for it to be in everything. I want the Nemesis system in Pokemon.
The Nemesis system is so good.
Wait, it kind of is already in Pokemon. You technically beat your rival every single time they come back stronger with different Pokemon.
But
I want
like,
it to be like a thing,
yeah.
Like, you like, beat them with a fire Pokemon,
Dude, imagine a Pokemon, right? Just walking down. You know how like they have like the routes or whatever, and you're just walking down a route, and a bug dude, right, battles you, and he beats you in a battle. And then as he beats you, he just like, he towers over your body and is like... take that, scrub, and then you black out, and then you wake up, and like you read like a, I don't know, like a magazine in game, and the magazine is like, top bug trainer is destroying all the gym leaders, and it's like he's like doing what you're wanting to do.
Oh my god! And then he's the final boss at the end of the game.
Like imagine like a random trainer then like building up to become like this huge like phenomenon, like sick trainer. That's basically what Shadow of War is, because like it takes the Nemesis system and then it like gives it crack, like the stories you hear about people, and I'm gonna read one because I read an article this morning that I thought was amazing, that I, like, took one account from the Nemesis system. The Nemesis system in Shadow of War takes the Nemesis system and like builds it out a lot more, and like, You'll sometimes have like enemies that, instead of you hunting them down, they're hunting you down. You'll have enemies that like rise from the dead. You'll have enemies that like are crazy. And that the personalities, and the amount of like, the voice acting is so good in this game. The writing is so good in this game. The stories, whatever. I still don't care about the story. That's like the one thing. The cutscenes though are really great. I will give it that the cutscenes are a lot better in this game than the first one. But I still don't care about. I don't care about Lord of the Rings in general, and so I don't care about the story. A lot of people are saying things about a sexy spider. Apparently, there's a sexy woman
Shelob,
in Shadow of War who's supposedly a spider. In this game, she's like a sexy woman. And she turns back and forth from a spider. I think that's how that works. But it's great. I'm only like 7 hours in at the most. I just gained the ability to dominate orcs or enslave them, as some people would prefer me say. And speaking of which, there's this article that I want to read. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read like the first half of it, because I think it's so good. But it's called Orc Slavery Made Me Quit Middle-Earth Shadow of War, Shadow of War, which sounds inflammatory.
And Vice posted this. No other place would post this besides Vice.
Besides Vice. But it's so the title, I think, is misleading because the title makes you think like...
It's Vice and Waypoint are the two people that would post this article.
Yeah, and Waypoint is Vice, and so, like, they're definitely people. But, like, the title, I think, is misleading in the sense that, like, when you read the title, you think that, like, oh, this is about how, like, Shadow of War lets you enslave orcs, and that's bad. But the way they go about their kind of take on this person's gameplay experience, I think, is phenomenal. So I'm just gonna read it real quick. This is from motherboard.vice.com if you want to read the whole thing. It says, developer Monolith Productions' newest game is set in the Lord of the Rings universe. Players take control of Talion, a dead ranger, haunted and animated by Celebrimbor, the elf who forged the One Ring. The pair both hate Sauron and crisscross Mordor, killing his soldiers and building an army of orcs to take him down. It's a great game with solid systems, but enslaving the armies of orcs to hunt your enemies is the real draw. These orcs aren't your typical video game NPC cannon fodder. They have backstories, passions, and conflicts amongst themselves. They're so well-rendered that I've become deeply uncomfortable playing the game. The heroes treat them terribly. The Wraith and Ranger abuse and slaughter orcs and dominate their feeble minds. There are consequences to your actions. The orcs remember things, hold grudges, and react to your leadership accordingly. In most games, this would be fun, but in Shadow of War, the orcs' AI and personalities are so vivid that it's also an emotional burden. I'm serious. I feel bad about Talion's, and by extension, my treatment of the orcs. I first met Horza the Dead in Cirith Ungol in the game's opening hours. He was just another orc. He stopped me in the street and made a speech about how he couldn't die, and that no matter how many times I killed him, he'd just come back. He was pale and black veins ran down his face. The bones of his enemies adorned his helmet like a morbid Galia. I thought he was awesome. Then I killed him. I wanted him in my army, but this is before I learned how to subjugate orcs to my will. So I slaughtered him in the street, assuming he'd make good on his promise to never die. He did. Hours later, in the lush forest of Nirn, he found me. He found me. I was hiding in a bush, and there he was. He called his fellow orcs, said he called to his fellow orcs, said he smelled man flesh, and pulled me out of hiding. After he tossed me to the ground, he told me he was older and the dirt below me, and once again mentioned that he'd never die. Fair enough, I beat him down, broke his will, and made him my personal bodyguard. Later, he gave his life yet again, protecting me in battle, and then he came back to life. I was on my way to start another quest when he found me again. He wasn't the orc I'd fallen in love with, but a twisted wreck. His body bore the scars of his recent deaths. The bone Galia was gone, replaced by a wrought iron mask enshrining his broken features. Stitches crisscrossed the limbs he lost in his most recent battle. Someone had sewn him back together. He was furious with me for leaving him behind, for forcing him to fight and die, for using him so badly. We clashed, I won, and I reached into his mind to pull him back into my fold, but he resisted. So I killed him. Again, hours later, he found me. The undead orc would not leave me alone. Thankfully, this time I was able to dominate his mind, but Horza had outleveled me. In Shadow of War, the player can only dominate orcs at or below their level. All the combat and death had made Horza too strong to control. Thankfully, the game allows you to humiliate orcs to lower their level and make them more compliant. I pushed the button to shame Horza, and his mind broke in my hands. He screamed in pain, gibbered, and said, "When is my rest?" over and over. I tracked Horza through the forest of Nirn and found him near a cliff, muttering to himself, "When is my rest?" He repeated in different intonations. He begged, he pleaded, he wondered aloud to himself. I pulled him close to me, dominated his weakened mind, put him in my orc stable, and immediately shut down the game. I haven't played it since. I can't get Horza out of my mind. And then it goes on, but I'm going to stop there. Because I read that and I was like, Jesus Christ, dude. Like,
that's pretty intense, actually.
Yeah, like, that's like that. And I haven't experienced something to that degree yet in Shadow of War, but I can see it building up to that because the orcs are so well fleshed out and they're so unique in their personalities and stuff that I'm blown away by that aspect of the game. But yeah, Shadow of War is cool. It's good.
Good.
yeah, I really felt like reading that on the show because I was like, that is such a cool story. And usually I don't read articles like that. Like, I usually I just like read news and stuff, but I was like, dude, that's actually pretty dope. I also watched Blade Runner 2049. It's a good movie.
How was it?
It was great. I say it's a good movie. It was an amazing movie. It was kind of confusing because it's a Blade Runner movie. Have you seen the first Blade Runner?
No, I've not.
The first Blade Runner I watched 4 years ago, and it is pretty long and kind of boring. It's fascinating. And like having watched that movie 4 years ago and kind of forgetting everything that happened in that movie and going into 2049, man, I was lost through like the first like 45 minutes of the movie. And even when I knew what was happening, I still didn't really know what was happening. But I'll tell you what, though, like, it might be one of the most beautiful movies I've seen as far as, like, cinematography and visuals. Like, I feel like in that movie, you could take a picture of any of the scenes, like, take, like, a screenshot, and it'll look beautiful. It'll look like something you can, like, set as your wallpaper on your computer or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I definitely recommend that for anybody who's looking for a movie to watch. I also watched the whole first season of The Boondocks for no reason this week.
I mean, not for no reason.
Wait, what did you say?
Well, not for no reason. You wanted to.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I wanted to. I played it randomly because I had Hulu through my sister, and so I was like, I'm looking for something to watch. Boondocks is on. And I was like, oh, I'll just put it on. Man, that show was amazing. That show, that cartoon, I feel like everybody should go back and watch it because it holds up, I feel like, better than it did even like when it was first released. Like, when it first released, I remember watching it. Maybe I'm just older now, but I was in high school when I watched it. It came out when I was like in middle school, but I watched it in high school, and I remember being like, "Oh, this is cool. This is awesome. This is funny. It's like it's black and all, and I can feel this. It's black. It's black, so I can feel it on another level." And like it did like the cool like anime, like it had like the fight scenes and like the anime mm-hmm. style and all that stuff. And I was like, "Oh, this is like made for me." Going back and watching it, I'm like, "Dude, this show is genius in its comedy." Like, there is an R. Kelly episode where R. Kelly was on trial for peeing on a girl. And basically, they were convinced people that R. Kelly was innocent just by being like, he's R. Kelly, like, playing his music and being like, pointed at the other lawyer, was like, but he has a white wife. And everybody in the room was like, oh, no, the lawyer has a white wife. It has, like, some, like, funny references and funny quips that are just so good. But yeah, go back and watch Boondocks, everybody. It's on Hulu. And finally, I watched that Star Wars trailer. And that trailer is dope. So I had to really say about it. Do you like Star Wars?
I'm indifferent. I like the movies, but I'm not a huge space boy, to be honest.
Yeah. Did you watch the trailer?
No, I didn't.
It's good. There's some things that happened. I don't want to say anything because I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but it was a great trailer. There's definitely some things that are implied in that trailer that are kind of crazy, but that's for another conversation. That's for that post movie conversation. Because me and somebody, maybe it'll be Alex or Moises, somebody who will probably watch the movie.
I actually want to, speaking of movies, by the way, I actually want to go see Blade Runner, and I want to come back and I want to have a post movie.
I'm down.
Talk with you about it.
Yeah, I do. I'm totally down. We can do a whole we can do either a spoiler section or a spoiler cast or something. Cause cool. Blade Runner, the thing I like about Blade Runner is that you have sci-fi, right? Like, you have sci-fi, like, Fallout or Fallout 4 specifically, or, what was the other one? Or, like, probably let's look at Detroit Become Human, stuff like that. And this is me assuming for Detroit Become Human. That's, like, base level, like, are androids human? Or, like, they introduce the idea of androids from, like, a macro perspective. Mm-hmm. Blade Runner, when you watch Blade Runner, it like bypasses all of the like large scope questions. It is like, hey, we're just gonna go get into detail here. Like, this is the post conversation after you've had that original conversation of like, are androids human? Now you're just seeing like these like, specific issues play out in specific situations. And it was a level of sci-fi, and I think this is what makes the movie that masterpiece, is that it was a level of sci-fi that like I am not used to, because I don't really get into like deep sci-fi. It was very much like, it very much expected you to know your stuff and be smart about the way that these questions and these situations are presented. And so I think you'll like it, because I think you're nerdy enough.
I'm like a cerebral kind of guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think your brain's wired that way, so that you'll like it. Because, like, for me, my brain's wired, well, part of my brain's wired in a way to, like, when I watch a movie, I'm looking at it for, like, the entertainment value, and not necessarily mm-hmm. for, like, the deeper, like, inner meanings. I do sometimes, or I do a lot of times, but, like, I like enjoying things. I think you tend to ask the deeper questions and, like, kind of break things down a bit, and I think you'd like it for that reason.
Thanks, buddy.
I got you, fam. Let's get into topics, because we have only one. But it's a long, it's like a deep layered one.
I feel like it's really not, to be honest.
Let's get into it, because it's been the talk all week. If you like listen to any like gaming outlet, any podcast, like they're all talking about the same thing. So I figured we should probably talk about it too, since everybody's talking about it. Mm-hmm. Which is, I have written here for topics, the microtransaction apocalypse is happening. So let's talk about it. Firstly, before we get into it, because I have three articles here that I want to cite. And I, like, gave you a required reading for this podcast, which I never do, but I figured we should have some examples to pull from if we're going to get to this conversation. But firstly, like, what are your opinions on microtransactions in games?
I think I was listening to the Giant Bomb or Giant Beast cast, and they were talking about their commandments for microtransactions and what games do it well and what games do it poorly. Mm-hmm. So my first experience with microtransactions was in League of Legends. And if you don't know, that's a free-to-play game that sells a secondary currency that allows you to buy characters and then cosmetics. So to me, it was a free-to-play game, and I had already put like hundreds of hours into it. So me investing all that time, I thought putting actual money into it, I didn't feel bad. And I didn't spend a single cent until I had spent already 100 hours of the game. So I didn't feel bad at all. So that's like kind of like my baseline. That's the baseline experience I have with microtransactions. But here are the rules that I have with microtransactions. That's my general opinions. Microtransactions should be cosmetic and not affect gameplay. That's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
And related to that, you can't give someone a resource in the last game only to make it a shittier experience and a paid experience in the next one. So mm-hmm. this is related to Destiny and the shaders, NBA 2K17 and the customization options.
Mm.
Those are my viewpoints on that. So, for example, Destiny 2, in Destiny 1, you got shaders that were unlimited that you could apply to your entire armor set. But in Destiny 2, they are more limited and you can gain a lot of them through the secondary currency using these like loot boxes essentially. And then NBA 2K17, they force you, or sorry, the amount of currency you get over time, they force you to use that currency to customize your character. But that same currency is the currency used to upgrade your skill points, which makes you better, which makes you get more stuff more quickly. So again, mm-hmm. in the past, they haven't had that be a thing.
Mm.
But yeah. In the newest one, it is. So that's my other rule, that you shouldn't give someone a good experience and then take it away only to monetize it. Microtransactions should be earnable. Anything you earn through a microtransaction, you should also be able to earn through other means. And then it should be simple and should only be used in multiplayer.
Hmm. Is that pretty much the bulk of it?
I mean, those are my thoughts, right? Like, the games that I think do it well are games like League of Legends, Overwatch. Games that I don't think do it well are Shadow of War, NBA 2K17, where there is a single-player aspect to it where, like...
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, and Destiny, to a certain extent, is single-player and multiplayer, right? So, like, the shader thing is hard because that breaks the first rule that I said before. You can't give someone a resource in the last game only to make it monetized in the next.
Mm-hmm.
That while it does follow the other rules where it's a multiplayer game, all the gear is earnable or whatever, that those rules are okay. But in Destiny 1, they gave us this resource after completing raids, after doing certain things. Like, they were like almost a form of an achievement system in a way. Like, there is a color, a shader in Destiny 1 that was all white, and you only gained that from getting a certain raid. And to me, that was like an achievement. Like, when you walked around the tower, if you saw people rocking all white with the glow around them, you're like, oh shit, that guy beat the raid. That guy's awesome. And like in Destiny 2, they've explicitly taken that experience away. And that is like one of the shittiest experiences I've had in terms of microtransactions.
Mm-hmm. Was one of your commandments that microtransactions shouldn't be in single player games, or did I mishear that?
Yes, my opinion is that it should only be in multiplayer games.
What about and Persona 5, right? Didn't they have like a thing where you could like buy the outfits for?
That is true. Persona 4? I did. That is true. I did do that. So yeah. The problem. So I guess that's not my commandment, but I guess it's more of a suggestion. If I had to suggest to a video game studio that was doing a single player game, I would say probably not a good idea to put it in a single player game. And also in regards to that, those costumes were so expensive and didn't really give you that much. And also that also broke the first commandment of you shouldn't give someone a resource only to make it monetized in the next game. Because in Persona 4, they gave you a lot of costumes throughout the course of the game. And in Persona 5, they made you buy a lot of them. So while I did do it, I did fall prey to that because I loved the Persona 4 cast and I love the Persona 4 music. Like, it doesn't, it still breaks the rule and I don't like it overall. Even though I did participate in it, I don't like the practice of it.
Yeah. I feel you. And, like, I guess we can get into, like, the two examples I pulled here. Both are from Kotaku. I'm not going to read the articles at all, but essentially, like, the first article I'm looking at says NBA 2K18 is riddled with microtransactions. And essentially, the summary of what it's saying is that, like, essentially in 2K18, if you want to play the single player, like, My Career mode, there are these currency points called VC, which, one, you can buy with, you can buy, like, a lot of it with actual money. In the game, like, gives you like 6,000 or 8,000, I can't remember the exact number, but a certain number to start off with that essentially adds up to like 2 upgrade points for like stats. And VC is used for everything in the game. So whether it's cosmetic, whether it's upgrading your player, no matter what it is, it's all VC, and VC is purchasable. And the game, from many accounts, like so many players have, I'd say like an overwhelming amount of players of 2K18 have been vocal about how this has stunted the game. Like, the game feels like a struggle to grind through because it feels very obviously pushing towards making players buy microtransactions to progress at an adequate rate. The other example is Shadow of War, which is a single player game. One I've just been playing, it has loot boxes in it, and Kotaku's article here is pretty much like, it's essentially everything you need to know about the loot boxes in Shadow of War. It's funny enough, this article is basically like saying like, yeah, they're kind of confusing, like they're convoluted.
Oh wait, sorry, speaking of that, I actually I don't know, I did mention that they should be simple, so yeah, that is one of my core commandments.
Yeah, and I totally agree. Like, I haven't looked at the microtransactions for Shadow of War. I'm still fairly early in the game, so I don't think I'd even need to at this point. And also from what I've heard, and I haven't had this firsthand experience, so I can't speak to it, but from reviewers, people like Dan Stapleton at IGN and other reviewers have mentioned that like the microtransactions in Shadow of War or the gameplay, you don't need to buy microtransactions in Shadow of War. Like, the gameplay feels adequate. There's no reason to buy them. In fact, Dan Stapleton himself, he was saying in his review that, like, if you buy the microtransactions, you're kind of ruining the game for yourself because, one, you're making the game a lot easier for you to play, and you're, like, you're jumping over hoops that is the gameplay. And also, like, you do not need to buy the microtransactions. And so that just seems to be that seems to be more of a case of there's loot boxes in this game for some reason. I think that is the thing, that it's a single player game with loot boxes, which is a new thing, since loot boxes are fairly a new thing, or fairly being popularized right now. It seems like a lot of games have loot boxes. So that's actually the next thing I want to ask you is, should single player games have loot boxes? Two, should games period have loot boxes? Because there's a lot of varying opinions on this.
I mean, single player games should not have loot boxes, I don't think. Well, I mean, you just cited two examples in which they only made the games worse. If a game company could take a single player experience and somehow incorporate loot boxes in a positive way that actually gave something to the game, I would be okay with it. But the fact is that with Shadow of War, It seems as half the time you don't even need it, and when you do need it, it's like at the very, very end of the game when you need to grind hard, right? So, like, that is shitty. Like, they're saying, hey, give me your money. You're at the end of the game. You want to win the game? Give me more money. That's the feeling, obviously.
But I don't think that's what Shadow of War is doing.
Well, I'm saying that's what they're saying in the review, in the article you sent me. It was saying that you only really would, the only time where it would even make sense to spend money is at the very end of the game where it's really grinding. And, like, that's shitty. Like, that doesn't feel good to me. And, like, in NBA 2K18, they gave you this resource in earlier games that you could earn more quickly so you could customize your character. Because let's be honest, half that game is customizing your character, and then made it a schlocky grind to get these points to give your characters fucking tattoos. Like 1,000 points to put a tattoo on your character. You can't even preview it so they can get more money in the microtransaction machine. Now, if there was a thing where, here's an example where in NBA, the loot boxes, it would make sense, right? Let's say you have your created character, right? And that has its own currency. So you can adjust your currency in the single player to be a rewarding experience where you can upgrade your stuff at a normal rate. Then you have like another mode, right? Where like maybe let's call it Dream Team or something, where you have loot boxes where in the loot boxes are random players from like the 80s to now, basketball players. And every time you open a loot box, it's one basketball player. And then you can add them to your dream team. And then that dream team can compete against other dream teams in simulated basketball matches. Because everyone has those conversations in the NBA where like, oh, well, Jordan from this year would totally beat LeBron from this year. Right. And then in that simulation game, that could be like a thing where you could say, oh, well, my dream team beat your dream team. And then, what I'm describing is a purely multiplayer experience without you. You're customizing a team, but you're not customizing your personal one-on-one character in the story mode, right? So that's where I feel like it would make sense. But the modes that are currently in games that are being cited with this loot box stuff, they're not making the game any better. They're only making it more complicated and thus making it seem as though they're just trying to money grab from people. The loot boxes are not designed as a mechanic well enough, and it just seems like a money grab.
Do you feel like loot boxes are well designed in Overwatch?
I think so, because it's simple. It's you can earn them, and you only get cosmetic stuff. And then if you're at the very end of an event, it's the same. Okay, Overwatch, I feel like it's the same feeling I got with League of Legends, where like the game, I did invest $60 in it, but like before I spent any money on it, I had already been playing it for like 70 hours, 60 hours or whatever. And then the money I spent, the time I put in, is like near even. Let's say I played 100 hours. I probably spent around like $100 total on that game. I don't mind spending $1 per hour, if that makes any sense. But I'm sure the time is actually completely opposite. Let's say I put in like 200 hours. I don't mind spending like $10 on a game I spent 200 hours on. Especially it's a game where I really like the designs of the characters. I like the company making it. They make a good game. The game feels fun. They're always putting new modes in it. Like, I don't mind, you know, putting money up for that. And like, that's not affecting my gameplay. It's only affecting the way my character looks.
Yeah. And I agree. And like, in terms of how I prefer loot boxes, or I prefer microtransactions in general, I prefer cosmetic. Like, I would rather not have any. I mean, if everything could be my way, there would be no such thing as microtransactions that affect gameplay. Now, for like free to play games, is a different conversation, especially for like mobile games, because mobile games now it's an established thing. That's like kind of what you expect going into it, and it would suck for console games or PC games for that to be the norm, right? Because we're actually paying for these, you know. And even if like it. For like something like League of Legends, right, it's different because it's a free-to-play game, which, like, changes the conversation. Yeah. For a full-price game like NBA, and even, like, Shadow of War to an extent, like, it gets muddy because Shadow of War, I see Shadow of War as a game that, like, I'm surprised, I don't know how well Shadow of Mordor sold. In fact, I should have looked that up for this conversation, because if I had to guess, I would guess that they needed to put microtransactions in that game for them to even approve that game getting made, because I assume that Shadow of War doesn't sell as well as like other games that they have on their docket. Who makes that game? WB? I don't know. So they also make Injustice, right?
Batman.
Yeah. I guess they don't really make anything that's like multiplayer or something that's like that I'd really consider to be like Injustice. A huge, like
Injustice is a massive multiplayer game that had loot boxes in it, and I think that loot boxes mm-hmm. for Injustice, the game was designed around that feature.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And that's from the same company.
I think I'm comparing them in my mind to Ubisoft, who, like, Ubisoft has a bunch of games that sell like crazy because all of their games are like, games are shifting to this place where now it's games as service, and so you have stuff like For Honor, Ghost Recon Wildlands, and like, what else is Ubisoft doing this year that's not South Park or Assassin's Creed? I can't think of anything, but looking at what's that game? The shooty game, Rainbow Six Siege. Right, like For Honor,
the shooty game, you know, that one, the shooty one,
the one shooty game, Wildlands, For Honor, Rainbow Six Siege. Those are games that are selling extraordinarily well, because of the nature of their game, right? And I feel like single player games nowadays are not selling as well. Like, you look at Dishonored, you look at, why can't I think of any single player games? You look at single player games in general, they're not selling as well. I feel like if you look at something like Shadow of War, I'd assume that if they hadn't put any microtransactions in that game, that it would not have.
But did we even really? Did we even really need to have a second Shadow of War game?
Yes, yes, we did. I needed it, Ian. I needed it. No,
I'm saying the gaming space. Did we really need it? Like,
I think so. Well, here's the thing. Also, I keep saying here's the thing. I keep jumping around.
What's the thing? Tell me the thing.
I just got done listening to a Waypoint podcast, and they're talking about the second death of the immersive sim, because we're now in a space where it seems like immersive sims are done. And when I say immersive sims, I mean games like Deus Ex, Dishonored, Hitman, games like those, right? Because they're not selling as well. Except for Hitman, which, I mean, Hitman sold well, but it's not selling as well as it needs to for it to continue, for the company not to sell it, EA or whatever it was, not to sell it, not EA, Square. And those games, I feel like, are some of the most valuable games in terms of what the gaming space needs, because those games encourage choice, they encourage interesting stories told by environment, they encourage a certain type of gameplay, and I feel like that's actually what the game space needs as far as great game design. But those games aren't getting approved to be made anymore because they're not profitable. Meanwhile, we have
they're not profitable within the same margins as a multiplayer game.
Yeah, like, you can make a lot more with games like GTA Online, which I love GTA. I think GTA 5 is one of the greatest games ever made. GTA Online is a mess as far as microtransactions. Like, that game it's one of the examples of a game that's a grind if you're not paying. And it didn't start off that way. It became that way. Games like Destiny, right? Which, I mean, the game space is shifting more towards, like, these games and services, PUBG. These are also great games. Like, PUBG is a wonderful game. So is Destiny, but we're seeing that a lot of other great games, specifically single player games, are being sacrificed in order to put money into these games that sell more, like Destiny in those games. And so I think that leads to us getting microtransactions in these single player games. Suckily enough. This last article is from Kotaku, and I want to get your opinion on this, because it's essentially about why microtransactions aren't going away soon. It was written by Ethan Levy, who's worked on games and specifically, like, consulted on microtransactions. And essentially, he breaks down some statistics. I'm just going to read here real quick. He says, last month I ran a survey about gamers' DLC and microtransaction purchasing habits. Over 2,700 gamers answered these questions about how they spent their money in the past 3 months. 1 in 10 gamers have purchased a microtransaction in a premium AAA game in the past 3 months. 6 in 10 gamers have played a free-to-play mobile game in the past 3 months, and 1 in 10 have made a microtransaction in those games. And then he has, like, this infographic here. If you want to find it, you go to Kotaku.com and search that article, why microtransactions aren't going away anytime soon. But the results are pretty interesting. Like, if you look, and he even has stuff for, like, pre-ordering games. Like, 55% of the people he surveyed had pre-ordered a game in the last 3 months. 90% had purchased the game. 25% had purchased a season pass. 51% had purchased a DLC expansion pack. 81% had purchased the game on sale, which also lends itself to the conversation of profits and stuff like that companies are making. 44% had purchased a game in a bundle, etc., etc. But essentially, he was kind of breaking down like how our purchasing habits are contributing to the existence or the needing of the existence for microtransactions.
I think that from that article, I like what I'm understanding is that games need another source of income because games are too expensive to remain profitable using the current tools that we have in the gaming space. Like, does that make sense or no?
Yeah. No, I feel like to make a full expensive to produce.
Yeah. Yeah, like to make a full-fledged like game. Like we just heard about Cuphead, right? Like people were like taking second mortgages on their house and like selling their cars to make the final parts of Cuphead because that's how expensive games are to make, right? But the problem is that games don't have a high return, like an ROI, a return on investment, unless they're a multiplayer game where you can buy things indefinitely with microtransactions. So the problem is that games are too expensive to make, and then the band-aid over that horrible reality is microtransactions. So, yeah. The only way to make that microtransactions go away or to lessen is to somehow make games cheaper to make, which is never going to happen. So, like, it's a reality that we cannot escape from because that's just how things are now. Games are just so expensive to make. The economy isn't as good as the economy isn't good, and games that are multiplayer make more money. So that's like how it is.
Yeah. I want to shift to questions because we have a lot of questions, and all of them are like all of them except one, I think, are about microtransactions. And so our first question has nothing to do with microtransactions, but I'll ask it anyway. Patrick Kennedy writes in and asks, "What's the ins and out of eating some ass?"
Well, anyway, next question.
comes from Eli at ShawDoggy on Twitter. He asks, he says, "I have a question about loot boxes. Why? Why loot boxes?"
I mean, we just kind of answered that.
Yeah, and like
games are too expensive to make.
Why? But why loot boxes over just like purchasing random stuff? Is it because loot boxes make more because people don't know what's coming?
Or exactly. Like
people buy multiple times.
If I tell you right now that a loot box is worth $1, but buying a skin that you want is worth $5, let's say $7 or $8, what are you more likely to buy?
Buy a loot box because you get the chance.
You have higher chances, yeah. Or like that, the mentality. Yeah. Even though you don't actually have higher chances, the mentality is that I'll spend less money if I just buy 8 of these individual things. Yeah. Also, like gachapon systems are very similar to gambling, and like gambling, it's very easy for your mind to say like, oh well, I'm saving money if I do it this way. Yeah, and then like on top of that, there's a whole gambling thing where like loot boxes are technically gambling. It's a whole other thing as well. But
yeah, and we're also probably gonna get into that. In fact, let's get into that right now. I'm gonna come back to this next question. J.R. Oliver asks, "Why does game media seem inconsiderate and out of touch dealing with real mental health issues regarding predatory practices?" And now, I'm gonna put some words in his mouth because I've seen him on Twitter tweeting about it. He's specifically talking about loot boxes and kind of like gambling addiction and the idea of whales putting in so much money and the thought of like whales being people who are essentially prey to these predatory practices.
Business practices,
yeah. What are our thoughts on games media seeming inconsiderate? Because I'm going to put more words in his mouth because he's talking specifically about one outlet. I'm not going to say who, because I don't want to like dox him. But
mouth it to me right now.
Did you?
Oh, that?
Yeah. Because on their show,
that person. Okay.
Because on their show, they're talking about personal choice personal responsibility. Essentially, something like that. Of like, if you know you have like, or they're just like, don't buy microtransactions, which I agree with. And like when it comes to something like gambling addiction, like if it's that much of a problem, like don't play games with microtransactions. Essentially, like that was kind of their point. And I think I agree with Drake Mill actually for the most part as far as like.
You just said that you weren't going to say who it was.
Dang it! I said his name. Oh, whatever. I don't care.
You're
anymore.
A moron. Anyway. here's my opinion on it, J.R. Oliver. The person you're looking to for this opinion is not a mental health professional. They're a games media personality. If you're looking to games media personalities to give you a intelligent, deep, thought about mental health in regards to current economic business practices, you probably should be listening to Bloomberg. You probably shouldn't be listening to Greg Miller. No offense to Greg. I love Greg. Everyone knows that. I love Kind of Funny. But that's his opinion. He's paid to give his raw opinion. And maybe he doesn't have any experience with mental health in the same way that other people do. So, I mean, that's the thing, is that you pay to have this person's opinion raw. You don't pay for them to have this, like, super refined, like, diverse opinion, if that makes any sense.
Mm. Yeah. Let me see if this is a question, because I'm sure somebody asked this before I just straight up ask you. I don't see any questions. So I'll just ask it. Do you view loot boxes as gambling?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I mean, I see gachapon mechanics in mobile games as gambling as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you think developers should be allowed to put loot boxes in their game?
Or yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, again, I don't have a gambling addiction, nor is anyone in my close circle of friends have a gambling addiction. I think personally, I'm okay with it, right? But I feel like if your game has microtransactions in it, maybe a good personal a good boundary would be like putting a notice at the beginning of the game, like, hey, this game has gambling features.
Mm-hmm.
If this is a problem for you, press this button to disable all microtransactions. And maybe that's the way we should do it in the future, is that if you don't want to see any microtransactions, there's a little thing in the beginning, like, this game has, like, DLC microtransactions, press circle to disable microtransactions in your game. Then you don't see the prompt, you don't get the shop option, and then boom, people that don't like the options can disable them, people that have gambling addictions can disable them, and yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I'd say even take it a step further and, like, the ESRB, I think they said that in their statement, they were like, they said that they don't view loot boxes as gambling, specifically because you're getting something out of these loot boxes. Like, you're putting in money into these loot boxes expecting to get something. Now, if it was the chance of nothing comes out of the loot boxes or stuff like that, then it gets more tricky. But, like, as far as it's the same concept as baseball cards or Pokemon cards, or like when you're at the arcade, when you have like that even like the mystery machines that pop out randomly, it's the exact same thing.
To me I feel like it's all about value differential. Like, getting a spray in Overwatch or a duplicate in Overwatch, that the value of that is far and away different than the value received from an event skin. So, like, let's do a duplicate, right? A duplicate like spray, you might get 10 to 50 coins for.
Yeah.
And the skins that are the event skins are 3,000 coins.
Mm-hmm.
And you only get 4 things per drop in Overwatch. So obviously the value in which you're getting is a massive differential. So the spray, you might as well not even have anything at that point. It's like it's like 1/10 or like even less than that. If the duplicate sprays are what I think they are, I think they're like 10 cents per or 10 coins per whatever per duplicate. So like you might as well not even be getting anything. So like it's like doing a slot machine and you get 1 cent back when you put in a dollar. Yeah, you're getting something back, but it's completely negligible. It's the same as gambling. It's the exact same.
Yeah. I think so. I said earlier, I think they should take it a step further. I think they should take it a step further, as in, I think the ESRB should start requiring, like, when you have microtransactional loot boxes, you post somewhere the chances of the drops or like the percentages and stuff like that. I think that's a way.
In China, you have to.
Yeah, in China, you have to. It's a law. I think in video games that should be regulated in some way, because I do think, like, I'm not as angry about it as like a lot of people in gaming communities are about the concept of loot boxes and predatory practices, mainly because like I feel like that is marketing in life. Like and Greg Miller kind of gave this example, but he also kind of butchered this example in his show. He was like, when you go to the grocery store, or you go to Walmart or something like that, like walking out, you can see like the things we were mentioning earlier, like the toy, like the randomization, kind of like the claw machines, like the machines that pop out a random thing, right? And I think somebody wrote in also saying that, like, well, you don't have those shouting at you every time you're playing a game. But I'm like, well, you have to go grocery shopping, and you're going to see those things walking out the store. Like, you have to go in public, you're going to see those things. Those things have flashing lights. Same way that, like, not the same way, a similar way of, like, you go to a gas station, right, and you have cigarette ads. I don't know if they still have these, but I remember learning about this in school, that there being cigarette ads, like, that are the same height as, like, children, because, like, when you want to sell people cigarettes, you aim at them at a young age to get them addicted at a young age. Like, marketing and advertising has always been bad, and it's always
predatory.
Been
yeah
predatory. Like, people, companies, advertisers, marketers, etc., etc., don't care about you. Like, and I can't say this enough, they do
they
not
never
care about
will.
Your well-being.
They literally never will.
Yeah, that's not their job. Isn't to care about you. Their job is to make money for themselves and to be selfish.
What's his name? Speaking of Shadow of War and not caring about you, there was a producer on Shadow of Mordor that died during production, and they they wanted to homage him by putting him in the game, but they put his ass inside of a fucking loot box. They trapped his soul in a loot box.
Yeah, you're able to buy him though. You're able to, like,
no, they after the controversy, they put him in the base game. But, like, what a what a scummy... My man's dies, and they trap his soul in the shadow realm of a loot box. What a fucking way. Fucking way to go.
Let's get back into the questions. Chase Williams asks, how much of this conversation is overrepresented by games, media, and enthusiasts, considering the revenue they produce? They must be popular. And we kind of discussed that a little bit, that, yeah, microtransactions are popular.
And these are two different questions. I don't think they're getting overrepresented in the media because they're becoming more and more popular in games today.
Mm-hmm.
So the more they keep coming up. I mean, Assassin's Creed Origin is coming out, and that has loot boxes. Like, we're seeing more and more single player games come up with loot boxes in them. So I feel like it's not underrepresented, the fact that it is important that games are including this feature that we mentioned before that is predatory on some people. I think it's important to talk about things that are scary to us and that could potentially be very detrimental to our gaming space. So I don't think it's overrepresented, and I think it's important to talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
And considering the revenue they produce, they must be popular. I mean, yeah, they are popular because it's gambling. Gambling is popular.
Yeah. And, like, so part of me feels that, like, it's now coming up in the conversation more and more because of the loot boxes. Because, like, the loot boxes have been popularized now, like, starting with Overwatch, kind of, like, coming out and being the guys to be like, hey, boom.
And then, Forza did it as well.
Also, Star Wars did it very poorly, apparently. Or it seems to be doing it very poorly because the game hasn't come out. But from the beta, people are like, ooh, these don't seem good. But, like, my view of it is microtransactions have always kind of been, not always, but, like, since, like, the PS3 and going into the PS4 era, have always been a thing. Like, I've always been able to buy cash for GTA Online. I've always, even last year, for Deus Ex Mankind Divided, I could pay money to get, like, an extra upgrade point for my character. So, these things have always been around, but the reason why it's coming back into the conversation now is because of loot boxes and where it's a new way of seeing it. Like, it's being reintroduced. Like, it's always been there, but now it's like, allow me to reintroduce myself, to reference Jay-Z. It's kind of that situation with loot boxes and us seeing, like, oh, man, like, what's this? This is a thing I haven't seen before, and it has to do with me spending my money. Also, loot boxes are kind of questionable, I think, in the public as far as, like, the nature of them, the inherent nature of loot boxes in gambling. Paul Warren asks, are shady AAA practices a slippery slope that makes games worse? Are AAA devs pretending to make less money than they really do? Which is an interesting second question. The first question we kind of already answered. Unless, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I mean, companies are created to make money. When they don't make enough money, they create new revenue streams, and this is a new revenue stream. And I do think that in some aspects it is shady, like with NBA. I mean, but the thing is, you need to know what companies you're dealing with. Are you surprised that WB is doing this in a shitty way? No. Are you surprised that Forza and Microsoft is doing this in a shitty way? No. Are you surprised that fucking Assassin's Creed is doing it in a shitty way? No. Like, these are game companies that are known for shitty business practices. So, like, but I guess it's, like, different for us because, like, we're more in the scene than other people. But, like, when you when you see behavior of a company over a long period of time, you start to build this persona of like, oh, like it wasn't EA like the most hated company in the world or whatever.
Yeah, like a lot of years ago. Yeah,
this is like, so are you really surprised that like they make something that like is shitty? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like no. So that's is it making games worse? Like yeah, maybe at the AAA space, but I think that half the best games that have been coming out the past few years aren't from the AAA space.
Mm-hmm.
Like Stardew Valley.
Yeah, I also want to clarify for like people listening, especially if you're a developer, because like I know a lot of this stuff comes from publishers and like the people who are in charge of like the marketing aspects of the game, because like I assume, and like this has been echoed in other podcasts, like I assume the way it goes is like devs are working on their game, they're making their games, right? And then like the publishers like give them a letter that just like, you open the letter, it just says, hey, we know you've worked hard on this game. Now we want you to ruin it. I assume that's how it goes.
Yeah. hey, listen, you really balance this game really well. It's so fun, but like, can you just ruin it? Can you just
like,
ruin
it? We know you've been working very like for like however many years on Shadow of War. When did that game come out? 2013, 14. We know you've been working hard 3 years. Yeah, mess up this game, please. But also,
just fuck me the fuck up, Captain.
Yeah, and I don't. And this is me not being familiar with the development or how development works specifically in big third party or AAA studios. But, I mean, there's different ideas of how it works, right? Of like, I'm sure there are also options that, in terms of how to implement microtransactions or how to monetize your game. I should say, like, I'm sure, lead devs may have like input of like, okay, well, players don't like this, but it seems loot boxes were working for Overwatch, so maybe put them in this game, and maybe this has just been a trend that is going to die after this year after seeing the response from players this fall. But either way,
to confirm, if you're a dev, we're not talking about you. When we say game dev, we mean game publishers. We don't mean you.
We love
all the devs that we know, and if there are any devs listening, we appreciate all the work you put in, because we know that you guys crunch hard and you guys work really hard, but it's 9 times out of 10 it's not your fault. So
yeah, and I don't think we've like said developers specifically, but I don't want developers to listen to this game. I don't know if developers listen to this game or podcast. I don't know if developers listen to this podcast and think we're talking about them, but more so we're just talking about the business. Let's see. Next question comes from Andy McFlandy. We got a lot of questions this week. We're almost done, though. Andy McFlandy asks, is the move to $70 or $80 AAA games inevitable, or is $60 here to stay with microtransactions and loot boxes to supplement costs?
Yep. The second one.
Yeah, I don't think... I think games aren't able to move to $70 or $80 because I think that puts it right out of... That puts them right out of that impulse buy range.
Impulse buy, yeah.
Yeah. Like, people don't want to just drop $70, but when it comes to $60 or even like in my case $47, because I have that Best Buy thing, or if you have an Amazon pre-order thing, or if you have certain memberships, you get games for $47. They're like lower prices, right? And that puts a lot of games within that impulse buy range.
Impulse buy. So, yeah. And plus half the time people try and get the publishers get more money out of you with collector's editions.
Mm-hmm.
As well. So like if you are willing to spend more on the game, then you buy that collector's edition. Or you do microtransactions. So like, if they can't make money in the normal $60 way, then they make their revenue streams different. So they make different editions, they make more physical products. That's why you see like a bunch of merchandise for Destiny and stuff like that, because they want to make more money off of their IP.
Yeah. And I also think when it comes to raising the price of games, like who's going to be the one to budge, right? Like is EA all of a sudden going to be like, hey, we're going to move our games up to $70. I don't think they can, because like then people are just going to be like, okay, I'll just buy Bethesda's games, or I'll just buy Ubisoft's games.
Or
like,
I'll just wait until a different basketball game comes out, or I'll wait until a different sports game comes out.
Or I'll wait till like, I can get this like on sale, or like there's so many other options as far. And like to be the first one to go up in price, it can just destroy you. I don't think publishers want that.
Especially with Steam having games come out like that, or again, like we have games that are free to play on the PC. We have games on Steam that are like on sale all the time. Like you can get games for like pennies to the dollar on like a Steam sale.
Yeah. And as far as are microtransactions here to stay, I think loot boxes might go away. I think publishers and developers are seeing the reaction now.
Multiplayer games will have them for sure.
I think because of Overwatch, now this year you're seeing like everybody take to them, because people the publishers and developers think, or maybe not developers, publishers think that, or companies think that people loved loot boxes, and so that's why they all flock towards them. Now that
when
you
in
see
reality,
backlash,
we don't like them.
Yeah, now that you see backlash against loot boxes, I think people maybe they won't get rid of them, but maybe they'll be more like, Destiny has Engrams, which are effectively loot boxes, right?
They are.
But you don't really see them as loot boxes, even though they are loot boxes. I think they'll be more like that of like, they're loot boxes, but they're like loot drops instead of loot boxes, or they're more subtle ways of handing you loot, or they're more subtle about the way they implement their loot boxes, as far instead of being over the top like, hey, here's a loot box. Richard Wood asks, would you be okay, oh wait, we kind of just answered this question. This is kind of a different question. Would you be okay with games costing $80 to $100 if it meant no microtransactions? I ask as with the rising cost of games and no price increase in games, how do we push the medium without making the same money percentage? So would we be okay with games costing more if it meant no microtransactions?
No, okay, because I'm not trying to spend $100. That's the thing. Like, mm-hmm. I'm fine with the way games cost now, and I'm fine with microtransactions the way they are, because if a game does here's the right way to put it. You can fail the execution of microtransactions. So if mm-hmm. I see a game explicitly fail its execution in that aspect, then I don't play the game.
Mm-hmm. I think fair. Yeah. I also want to ask you this. Do you believe in, like, because I've been seeing a lot of people.
Do I believe in God? Yes.
I mean, that too. No, do you believe in, like, boycotting games that implement microtransactions, even, like, or that either have microtransactions or loot boxes or don't implement their microtransactions well, et cetera, et cetera? Because I've been seeing a lot of people just, like, be like, I'm not buying this game. And, like, I think that's a prerogative, but I want to know, how do you feel about not buying a game that's doing particular things?
I think that if you were on the fence about a game and you don't buy it because they implement this business strategy in a bad way, I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing. Like, I was never a huge Shadow of War fan. I didn't even beat the first game. So, like, for me, someone who is like, oh, this game is part of the zeitgeist, maybe I should get into it. And then I see this as, like, it's like a barrier to entry. It's another barrier to entry, essentially. So that is just another thing stopping me from impulse buying the game, you know?
Mm-hmm.
As to, is it a legitimate reason to not buy a game? Yeah, I think so. I think it's just another, it's a business practice that you don't want to affiliate with, so.
Yeah, and I was actually kind of there. Like, before the game came out, even, like, weeks before, when I first heard that Shadow of War was going to contain loot boxes, and when the word was that, like, they didn't implement them well, I was like, oh, well, I'm not going to get Shadow of War. Like, I was completely like, well, I'm not getting this game. And part of it was, like, a boycott thing of, like, I don't like microtransactions. I hate them with a passion. I understand why they exist. I just don't like the feeling of playing a game and having to grind, and then having the thought in my mind of, is this game, am I grinding because this game I'm supposed to grind, or am I grinding because
of the loot boxes?
They want me to spend money. That's like yeah. if Persona 5, for example, had ways I could spend money on the grind of the game, I would hate that game. Because
I mean, you technically already can. If you buy the Persona 5 or Persona 4 costumes, they give you an EXP boost.
Oh, interesting. But is it like, if it feels like more like egregious of like, I don't know, like I could just buy a level for a dollar for all my characters, like buy a dollar, all your characters level up a level or something like that. Then I'd hate it, because as I'm playing, I'd be thinking, I'd have that thought in my mind. Even if the game is the exact same as it was, I still have that thought in my mind. That's kind of like,
you're like, oh, this is shitty.
Yeah. Like when I was doing my Game of the Year list last year, I was contemplating on putting Let It Die on there, even though I hadn't played it as much as I'd feel comfortable with putting. I don't even know if I put it on there, but I didn't felt as comfortable and with the amount of time I spent with it. And also, it was the fact that it was free to play, and so I was like, well, I don't know I'm 5 hours into this game now. If I get 10 hours, is this game going to gauge me my money? If I get 15 hours into it, is this game going to then be like, hey, pay us? And having that in my mind is like the worst thing about playing a game, because that ruins the immersion. That makes me think about my wallet rather than just think about playing the game or think about grinding in the game. which is not fun. So yeah, what was the question? Would I rather no, I'm fine with microtransactions if it means not paying $80 for a game. Because I never buy microtransactions anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's get into the last question, which comes from Rihanna. She asks, how do you see microtransactions differing from games as a service? And where is the line of acceptability drawn for you personally? I think free-to-play, it kind of feeds into this a bit, because I think for free-to-play games, like, feel free to ask me to pay for your game in your game. I mean, I don't play free-to-play games because I hate microtransactions, but, like, for games that are free-to-play, I feel like it's okay to have those in your game because you have to get paid somehow. When it comes to games as a service, so thinking of games like Destiny or, like, PUBG, I don't really play many games as a service, so it's hard for me to even answer. But or GTA Online is one I do play. It's hard because it's all about balance. I paid $60 or whatever it was for a GTA Online or GTA 5, and so to play online for me to feel like the grind is hard because it feels like they're asking me to pay them. I feel like in GTA Online it feels egregious. It doesn't feel good. But at the same time, I don't feel it as heavily because I'm not. It depends on what I'm trying to do in the game to what that kind of affects how I feel about it. But I don't know. I know that wasn't a good answer, but
no, I feel like I answered. I don't know. It was a good answer. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. I think that my level of acceptability is kind of what I just mentioned. Is that like if it's implemented poorly, then I won't play the game for the most part. Like if I'm on the fence about buying a game and then I see that there's shitty loot box practices or something like that, then I won't play the game at all. Like Street Fighter V, I like the game a lot. And it does have somewhat shitty practices when it comes to the fight money stuff. I still play the game because I really enjoy the game, and I wasn't on the fence. I was already going to buy that game no matter what. But if, again, like I mentioned before, with Shadow of War, I'm on the fence about that game, and hearing all the stuff about the business practices puts me in the red, which means I'm not going to buy the game.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Awesome. Ian, thank you for having this conversation with me. I feel like this is great. I feel like this is one of our better episodes, like one of probably the top 10 OKB's podcasts. I think so. I enjoyed this conversation. It was a very, like, deep dive, kind of intellectual, like usually we're just on here talking about, like, DK64 and, like, how many black people do we need to put in these Marvel movies because we need more of them.
More.
Like, yeah, we need more. The answer is more. But, yeah, I feel like this is a good one. Do you have any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
No.
No?
I don't know. I'm go listen to A+ Anime season wrap-up.
Oh, yeah, do it. Listen to Pixel Pulse Radio, because you don't really shout out Alex enough.
Shout out to PP Radio. That's the name of the new... Shout out to PP Radio.
I wonder if you knew that as he was there. You probably did do that on purpose.
A+ Anime and PP Radio are beefing now. I'm causing within... podcast within network beef now.
Podcast beef. Do you think... That has to be a thing. There has to be two podcasts.
There has to be.
I mean,
Beast and Irrational... Okay, Beast and Irrational Passions, official beef.
Come at me, Alex O'Neill. You short. I don't even know if he's short. I don't think he's short, actually. I've seen him.
He's tall. He's very tall. That's a bad.
Is he very tall?
Yes. Tall?
I feel like he was like average height when I saw him. Maybe he is tall and I just wasn't paying attention. Alex O'Neill is tall. I don't pay attention to things. I don't look. I don't like open my eyes. how do I insult Alex O'Neill? I don't have good roles for Alex. I don't really sit
down
and think
about roles.
You handsome,
tall,
for Alex.
Brown-haired looking. Let's finish this before we hurt people's feelings.
With the longest podcast of all time. Why don't you make your podcast shorter, Alex O'Neill? Remember that the OKB's podcast is a weekly gaming, nerd, and culture-centric show. This is where we get together and talk about the biggest topics in games and culture. If you like the show, subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice. Visit OKBeast.com and follow at OKBeast now on Twitter and Instagram. You can, of course, follow Ian at IanWhyNot on Twitter. You can follow me at Blessing Jr. That's Blessing JR on Twitter. Until next time, say bye to the people, Ian.
Bye-bye.